Welcome to Dads on the Air. We recently launched our newly designed website at dadsontheair.net. As part of the process of switching to the new site, the address to subscribe to our podcast has changed. If you downloaded this show manually from the website, you don't need to do anything. If you're subscribed to the Dads on the Air podcast via iTunes, you also don't have to do anything. However, if you're subscribed to this podcast using another method other than iTunes, you may have to resubscribe by clicking on the podcast link on the front page of our new website at dadsontheair.net. Thanks for your attention. Now here's this week's show.
We're Dads on the Air. We're here 'cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're Dads on the Air. We're Dads on the Air.
Welcome to Dads on the Air for Tuesday, the 28th of July, 2009. Should be a very interesting show coming up. We have a psychologist who goes by the name of Van Fortis, a chap who's been in private practice for 25 years, done a brilliant series of pieces for the web, and we're going to play them on the family courts and domestic violence and a whole range of subjects. Really interesting stuff that we're going to play. First up, we're going to be looking at a new section on, there's been a lot of movement this week over the debate in Australia about shared parenting. We now have a left-wing government in power and they are rolling back the shared parenting laws faster than you can say whatever you want to say. And, of course, a lot of blokes want to say quite a lot. We have, thanks to the miracles of modern technology from the country, Peter Vanderford. You there, Peter?
Sure am, John. Good morning.
Good. He's a major contributor to the program. We have Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Good morning, John. Good morning, listeners.
And myself, John Stapleton. Now, the news. Away you go.
Okay, well, a lot of action in The Australian over the last week. Caroline Overington seems to be leading the charge. She wrote on July 24th under the heading Shared Parent Laws for Rethink. Federal Attorney General Robert McClelland has pledged to make changes to the Howard government's contentious shared parenting laws and to the entire family law system to ensure the safety of children after divorce. In a speech due to be delivered today, Mr. McClelland will cite the case of Darcy Freeman, the little girl thrown from Melbourne's Westgate Bridge, allegedly by her father during a custody dispute, as a reason for the review. Darcy's father, Alan Freeman, faces a murder charge for allegedly dropping his daughter over the edge of a bridge in January, which was a tragic case. I won't go into the details of it here. Mr. McClelland has appointed former family court judge Richard Chisholm to conduct the review of the family law system, particularly in the context of family violence. His decision to intervene comes after an avalanche of complaints about the way the family law system is working, particularly in relation to the custody of children. The Australian understands several prominent women from Kevin Rudd's front bench, including Minister for the Status of Women Tanya Plibersek and Health Minister Nicola Roxon, are concerned about the way family law is operating. Peter, what do you think of all that lot?
Mate, where do you start? It looks to me like the family court, the anti-shared parenting lobby, are currently engaged in a smears and vilification campaign against fathers and men. Putting one single case of a father throwing his child off a bridge following being pushed over the edge by a system that's hell-bent on removing fathers from their child is ludicrous. You can't just put forward one case like the Darcy Freeman case as being representative of what men do. How many other fathers have thrown their children off the bridge? How many women have thrown their
Well, that's more to the point. I mean, we could cite numerous cases where women have murdered their children. I mean, there's the baby in the suit case, and one example springs to mind, of where women have done exactly the same thing. And of course, as we found out last week interviewing from Western Australia, the statistics show that mothers are far more likely to be injuring children than fathers.
Exactly, but they choose to ignore all the reputable studies that, that show exactly that, that, that their children are more in danger of being abused by their mothers and their live-in boyfriends or together or by the boyfriend rather than by their biological father. They're the least likely to abuse and injure their children.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's go on with this campaign by Caroline Overington, which was conducted in The Australian last week. On the next day, on July 25th, she wrote under the heading Divorced Dads Fear Rollback of Parent Laws. The shared parenting laws that have given divorced fathers more time with their children will be rolled back because of the power of left-wing feminist women in Kevin Rudd's cabinet. That is the view of men's groups that lobbied for the laws when the Howard government was in power and who now fear that 15 years of progress in getting fathers and children to spend time together is about to be undone. Sue Price of the Men's Rights Agency is quoted as saying, "I met with Attorney General Robert McClelland a few weeks ago and it was clear to me that these laws are being rolled back. They, the Rudd government, say that they are reviewing the law, but basically the law will change because in the Labor government there are a number of women who are well and truly indoctrinated in the 1970s feminist movement background and they do not value the role of men in society. Tanya Plebisek pushes domestic violence based on incorrect data. Nicola Roxon dances a merry dance around men. The fact is that children are at far greater risk from their mothers. Mothers kill more children than fathers, and that's a fact." And that is according to Sue Price of the Men's Rights Agency. Anything to comment on that one, Peter?
Well, I couldn't agree more. Sue's, as always, he's right on the button. And look, the current government and its bureaucracies are stacked to the rafter by those driving their own twisted personal agenda of what is best for the nation's parents and their children. They have persistently ignored the wishes of the vast majority of the general public on the continuity of shared parenting following parental separation, while at the same time the voices of reason and logic have been ignored and ridiculed. If anybody should be in doubt about the direction of this Back to the Future Australian government, one needs to look no further than the appointment by our current Attorney General or former Family Court Judge Richard Chisholm to review family law processes. I remember you and I singing in the studio following his presentation of a song. He changed the words to the
That's right,
Old
yes.
Smokey, and you brought your guitar in and we sang a reply to his comments. I mean, this man was joking, enjoying
the pain of separated fathers. He definitely was. He thought it was most amusing, something worth making a silly little ditty about and making fools of all of us. But really, in reality, he only made a fool of himself.
Exactly, but at the same time, this man is now put in charge of reviewing the family law processes. So there's not much chance of it remaining as it is. They're obviously hell bent on turning the clock back, 30 years.
Yeah, no, it seems that way. The feminist agenda, the feminist juggernaut, completely ignoring the facts, completely ignoring all of the studies, all of the statistics that are rolling in to the contrary, will continue to push this ridiculous feminist agenda. But anyway, getting on with this campaign, Michael Pally has written in and yesterday's Australian, under the heading Fathers Misread Joint Parenting, Family Court Chief Justice Diana Bryant has described the contentious shared parenting laws as problematic and the expectation of fathers as a concern as the government embarks on three inquiries into family violence. Well, what do you think of that, Pete? I mean, that paragraph itself, the idea that shared parenting laws are problematic. I mean, surely the old regime where they gave all of the power and everything to the mothers was problematic as well. It seems that the only concern here, really, is that fathers might actually get some justice for a change.
Well, as he says, it's not problematic as far as the court's concerned. because they never had a problem with it. They could see from day one that the status quo would basically remain unless you have a generational change of the judiciary. He said it's not seen as a concern inside the court, but the expectations of the parties are the problem. Stephen Winspear of the Victorian Law Institute's remarks that we have this terrible expression, which is that there shall be a presumption of joint responsibility, he said. That is not joint time, but as soon as it says the word joint, people jump on it and think they have got all these rights. That was the problem. It was being promoted in 2006 to the public as
a fair system.
Time provision rather than a starting point that could be altered due to the circumstances of the case.
Well, Michael Pally goes on to write, the Chief Justice, Diana Bryant, also says punitive costs orders for those who raise false allegations of violence have been counterproductive and that women fear being branded unfriendly. Knot of words adds up to the idea that the Chief Justice seems to believe that it's okay for women to make false allegations about domestic violence, and if they're not allowed to make these false allegations, they consider that right to taken away to be unfriendly. I mean, that just seems like a huge load of contradiction to me.
Well, in fact, what the proponents of rolling back the shared parenting laws are suggesting is the removal of the due process of law from the family justice system. The proposal is to reward perjury and perverting the course of justice in family courts by allowing malicious false domestic violence and sex abuse allegations to go unpunished because it might upset those engaging in this criminal behaviour. At the same time, we have a 70-year-old retired federal court judge serving a 3-year prison term for the same offence over a $70 speeding fine. So it appears that our judiciary and the anti-shared parenting lobby see the forcible removal of children from their fathers on the word of a perjurer as less offensive than the perjurer's attempt to avoid a $70 speeding ticket.
Yeah. Going on with this article, Michael Pally further writes, the Chief Justice said the shared parenting provisions of the Act, Section 65 DAA and 61 DA, were, to quote, problematic. But she said the principal issue concerned perception of the reforms, which created a presumption that the best interests of the child were served by a meaningful relationship with both parents after divorce. Peter, isn't that the fact that surely the best interests of the child are served by a meaningful relationship with both parents after divorce? She's saying,
of course it is. You stop abuse by putting checks and balances in place, not by removing them. And removing fathers and removing punishment for false allegations designed to remove fathers from their children, it just basically buys time for an alienating parent to turn the children against the other parent, and they know they can't be punished. The best interest of a child is best served by having both of their parents in their lives following their parent separation. Just because people can't get on together doesn't mean that one or the other is suddenly becomes abusive to the children or has been abusive to the children.
Absolutely.
It's double standards that they're putting forward.
Well, it's also putting children in jeopardy. I mean, by removing the protection of a father, of a biological father, they are opening the child up to more abuse and to more domestic violence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
There are safeguards already in place. If it's proven that a father has been abusive, then he can have supervised contact. There's nothing to stop people still remaining in contact because, after all, in most of these cases, they are allegations. And if there's no reason for a parent to hold back on making an allegation, but the idea is to prevent them from making false allegations, and taking away punishment for making false allegations just goes against the process, due process of law, and it's a criminal offence in other jurisdictions. So why should you take that away in family law?
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks, Peter. We'll just go to a short break and we'll be back in a moment.
but he resists. One man washed on an empty beach, one man chained with a
honour of having from Tasmania a psychologist who's been in practice for 25 years and goes by the stage name, if we can call it that, of Amphortas. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, you've done a whole series of broadcasts, you call them, that have been basically you've put up on the web. We love them. We're going to play them all over the coming weeks, and we're going to play a selection of them today, and I think they're really fantastic work. Can you just, first of all, we're going to play one called Stolen Generation, Part 1. So can you just give us a little bit of the background about how you came to be doing this?
Yes, well, originally I was persuaded by a men's rights advocate by the name of John Diaz in America that he'd like to know a little bit more about me and hear my voice, because so much men's rights advocacy goes on the internet with no voices, of course. So I was persuaded to make a podcast, and my son actually gave me a nice podcasting microphone for Christmas, which spurred me into actually doing something. So I started making podcasts. And this particular one that we're talking about today is about the family court. Not so much how it works, but the rationale behind it. And in particular, a book which was written in 1973, which was right at the start of the family court era, which lays down basically what we could call the rules for guiding judges and lawyers and so forth.
And that was?
Well, it's a book that's called... what's it called now?
Don't worry about it.
The Least Detrimental Alternative is part of its title.
Mm.
The Least Detrimental Alternative, and I make the point in my podcast that that when we are talking about families and children, surely the best alternative is what should be found, not the least detrimental. And yet that is precisely what the courts do. They look for an alternative to the family that is detrimental. And
so
that has to be borne in mind.
Have you kept an eye on the recent debate over shared custody in Australia? Do you? How does that relate to what we're about to hear?
Well, I think the shared custody thrust is obviously very important, and it should be the very first consideration in any considerations of how a post-divorce family manages itself, both parents. I tend to hold a very strong view on the duties of parents, that both parents are totally and wholly, jointly and severally responsible for every aspect of their children. Both parents, not the state. The state should not be involved, but it should be both parents being totally, wholly accountable for the welfare of their children.
Now, look, commentators such as Stephen Baskerville describe family courts as the most totalitarian institution to have ever arisen in the recent times. What's your view of those?
I think we have to have a look at the history, John, of the family court. The family court and the divorce laws, which are currently in use in most Anglophile nations, originated in East Germany during the time of the communist dictatorship there. We have brought across, holus bolus, the anti-family and anti-Western views of the East German government. Now, it should be borne in mind as well that the East German government eventually considered that it had failed, that the damage that was done by their own laws, the damage done to their own people, was so great, the social dislocation was so great, that they abandoned the very laws that we consider to be normal in our family courts.
All right, we're going to go straight to the piece. This is Stolen Generation, Part 1.
Okay.
Hello, this is Amphor Tass, and the title of this two-part podcast is The Justification for the New Stolen Generation. I dedicate this podcast to my estranged daughter, who I miss so much, and to my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. Here in part one, I will discuss how a book written in 1973 lies at the heart of the family court practices and the damage that is being done to our children, to fathers and society, to truth, justice and the family. One of the difficult issues we have in trying to deal with parental disenfranchisement is that few have an adequate explanation for it. To many, it is an issue that they just cannot understand. To others, it barely crosses their mind until it happens to them. When a child is taken away from you, it produces a kind of intense, speechless frustration and despair, a heartbreak, a rage in some, a devastation to so many. A parent cannot retreat away from the sense of blame, of shame, of having shirked responsibility, and a deferral to forces beyond their control. It is disempowering. A few mothers know what this disempowerment feels like. Many, many fathers do. It stems from and produces situations that are complicated and human, while not beyond normal humane resolution. It is the result of handing daily family complexity over to political determination, public policy makers, and inevitably the courts. And the courts do what they always do. They make a decision. You might not like it, but that's what you get. Routinely, in all Anglophile countries, family courts, divorce courts, disenfranchise and dispossess fathers of their children and saddle them with an intense heartache and financial costs, both of which last for years. There is a cost to the children too, the loss of a loving parent and a higher risk to all aspects of their little lives. Of course, were this to happen to a specific ethnic group, such as Aboriginals in Australia, all hell breaks loose. Reports are written and are emotively titled The Stolen Generation. The Chatterati shout loudly about human rights, and the Australian Prime Minister is told to apologise and make recompense. But fathers, who suffer far more from the everyday and far greater stealing of children from them, have no such vocal advocates and no apologies offered. No official authority speaks for them. No one is speaking for the children either. We have a generation of fathers who are shell-shocked and want to know why, in the face of manifest injustice, the courts decide what they do and why so many are complicit in this tragedy. There is a book which goes some way to giving at least a partial explanation. It is a sort of necessary reading, a Bible for the family courts and divorce court judges. It is called The Best Interests of the Child, The Least Detrimental Alternative, written Goldstein and Freud. It was published in 1973, right at the start of the ubiquitous family court and no-fault divorce era. By the way, that's Anna Freud, daughter of the largely discredited psychoanalyst of the last century. Associated with this book, she adds the cachet of psychological respectability and maternal empathy. It is of interest that the initial part of the title, a very widely used phrase today, comes from Mein Kampf, written by Adolf Hitler, in which he wrote, "People will accept any limitation to their freedom if you tell them that it is in the best interest of the children." Did you know that it came from the National Socialist Adolf Hitler? The blurb on the back of the book asks some questions. What principles should guide the courts in deciding the fate of hundreds of thousands of children involved every year in parental divorces and family breakdowns? What should justify state intrusion on the privacy of family relationships? How should professionals, judges, lawyers, social workers, psychiatrists and psychologists conduct themselves in pursuing the best interests of the children who have been abandoned, neglected and abused? Take note of that last phrase, children who have been abandoned, neglected or abused. And the book is such a justification for the intrusion by the state and more, for cruel and unusual punishment of children and fathers. Over the past 40 years, that punishment has become very usual, and all of society is feeling the pain. The least detrimental alternative in the title at least recognizes that all the alternatives up for discussion are detrimental. But what sort of mind can settle for the least detrimental when positive and helpful alternatives can be found with just a little empathy and compassion and thought? The book is used to guide the conduct of the 70% of divorces initiated unilaterally by women against perfectly innocent, loving fathers when no abuse or neglect or abandonment is a reason. Such circumstances cry out for an empathetic response and some help for families, not a detrimental alternative. It seems to be a manual of sorts, a cookbook, although it repeatedly uses the word guidelines to explain itself. It appears on a variety of reading lists for family court law courses and professionals at large. Indeed, the preface claims, "It would be difficult to imagine an expert working in the field of child custody or family law in the United States or in Canada, England or many other nations, and that includes Australia, of course, who has not been influenced by this book." On the back, a professor of psychology at Yale demands, "Without question, it should be compulsory reading for judges, lawyers, social workers and clinicians." the American Bar Association's juvenile and child welfare law reporter, is quoted, "Essential reading for anyone charged with the protection of children in the legal process." So what principles do guide the courts? And what does justify state intrusion, which snatches children from fathers in particular, even where no wrong has been done, no abuse or neglect or abandonment involved? And how do professionals conduct themselves in the pursuit of the best interests of children? These are not normally stupid people. The courts run on principles of law, and the professionals are schooled in ethics. But caution, they are the Frankfurt School ethics, cultural Marxist. They are fallible human beings who have all the usual professional integration issues, which include contending with practical day-to-day income earning that conflicts with an insidious ideology that underpins their education. They are educated in our universities, still reeling from the cultural Marxism onslaught of the 60s, 70s and 80s, and earning a living in a free market environment. This is particularly so for the lawyers, the social workers, psychiatrists and psychologists. Where they must compete for their own small local market share, the more socialist public purse handout money they can get, the better they get on. The effect on these professions, becoming rent-seeking scum, feeding off misery. The more misery they can generate, the more income they get. The judges, of course, have an untouchable public trough salary of epic proportion all sewn up. Who will fight against a system that pays them $250,000 every year and a fat pension, with absolutely no criticism of how they conduct their office? In fact, no scrutiny. I acknowledge that they are fallible human beings, and they work in an environment where they must follow certain rules to solve difficult personal, sometimes intimate problems. Sometimes the problems are so difficult that they fall back blindly on whatever rules seem to apply, and thoughtful justice dies. They follow certain rules laid down as precedent, both in the court itself and in their professional spheres. But starting from a particularly anti-family Marxist-feminist bias, such precedents build to a body of practice that gets more draconian, vicious, anti-family, anti-father, anti-male, and anti-Western society by the day. The problems dealt with by the family court are complex and intimate, and to make matters easier to deal with, such everyday normal legal principles as truth, evidence, and proof are dispensed with, and likely balance of probability used instead. It is a least common denominator approach. Perjury, which is predominantly from the mothers, is ignored as emotion. Prevention of future possible abuse drives a just-in-case punishment attitude, despite no grounds of past or present incidents. False allegations become the tactical devices of combative lawyers. The short review of the book at Amazon.com points out, many conclusions are controversial. But controversy is nipped in the bud by the secrecy rules which do away with the transparency of justice that every other type of court abides by. It is a star chamber. The professionals have their own confidentiality rules that hide their practices too. The argument, as Amazon says, is tight and well presented. One might even say seductive, unless that is you're a parent looking straight down the barrel. Let us look for a moment at the principal author, Anna Freud, a posthumous author. She was Sigmund Freud's youngest daughter. She was apparently his favourite and sought to follow at least partially in his footsteps, but focusing on the psychoanalysis of children. Wikipedia provides an outline of her life and notes that she did not have a very close bond with her mother and had difficulties getting along with her siblings. She suffered from depression and eating disorders. She was extensively psychoanalyzed by her father. The intrusiveness of that, and the emotionally conflicting transference and resentment issues should raise a few question marks. She was not exactly what we would call a normal child. Her experience of the average late 20th century family was virtually non-existent. She established and worked at the Hampstead Child Therapy Clinic, which is now named for her. She learned much of the impact of deprivation of parental care on children from young war victims and particularly concentration camp survivors. The children concerned that she had such a reasonable and humane interest in are clearly a far cry from those refugees from the modern divorce industry, and to implicitly treat them as equivalent would be an egregious error. In part two of this podcast, I will look more closely at some of the guiding principles advocated by the authors and the sheer bias and twisted thinking that is guiding our family law practitioners. Some explanation and understanding may be had. I end here thanking my good friend Christian Jay for his help in presenting this podcast. Thank you for listening.
And we're back talking with Amfortas, as he goes by the name of. Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. Excellent piece of work, mate.
Good. I'm glad you liked it.
Now, how hard was it to do all that?
Well, not too hard. I did have a little bit of help from a father in the United Kingdom who helped with the script, and he goes under the blog title of thedisenfranchisedfather.com. And he had quite a hand in putting together some of the points, and at the end of the second podcast, you'll see that I do give him some acknowledgement.
Look, one thing that fascinates me is we're just about to republish a book called Chaos at the Crossroads, which we published earlier over family law reform. And in some of the research I've been doing, it's very clear that the government has been completely aware of the damage that this has done to fathers and the distress that fathers have felt for many years. In 1985, the Bulletin, you know, the now defunct Bulletin, ran on its front page a story about the divorce industry and the harm that it was doing to men. And that was based on research by a family court counsellor called Peter Jordan, who found that they weren't getting over the divorce, that they were incredibly distressed years afterwards, and were really suffering in many different ways. You've found the same thing, haven't you, in your practice?
Yes, lots of times, yes. And that's over a 25-year period that I've been in practice and dealing with a lot of families who are wholly and totally distressed and destroyed by family court action. And yes, the government has been aware of it, and the government is, for want of a better word, infiltrated by the most virulent feminist ideologies that hold back the dissemination of truth about what's happening. And I think you'll find in the second podcast, which is coming up, the subsequent part to this this whole issue, I do talk about parental alienation being the first step that the family court takes. The family court starts the process of parental alienation, and it has detrimental effects not only on the children but on society.
And what do you mean when you say that? How does it start it?
Well, insofar as what I advocate and what I understand Fathers for Dads on the Air advocates is shared parental custody. Now, the family court does not operate on this basis, regardless of the noises that have been coming out of the government in recent years. The family court does not take its direction from the government. It takes its direction from the Family Law Act. And that does not have provision for shared parental custody as the default position.
Which, do you believe they should?
Well, yes. It should be the first position considered, that both parents, as I say, are totally and wholly responsible and accountable for the welfare of their children before anything else. And it is only when it can be shown that there is abuse or neglect that the state should intervene at all.
All right, well, just mention, there's been a relaunch of our website, www.dadsontheair.net. That's mm-hmm. dadsontheair.net. It's been redesigned, a wonderful redesign by Greg Andreessen, who's our researcher, and you would just like to thank him right this second for a wonderful job that he's done.
Excellent job.
Beautiful. It's a really nice redesign. It's much clearer, more simpler. There's a lot more functionality to it. So if you haven't been to our website for some time, please do check out www.dadsontheair.net. Now we're going to go to a song, and after that we'll play section two, after which we'll be back talking with Amfortas, who's a psychologist with 25 years experience practicing in Tasmania. We'll be back.
I gave her my love, she gave me my agony. I gave her monogamy, she gave me my agony. I gave her a home, she gave me my agony. I gave her my life, she paid me with my agony. My agony, my homelessness, futility. I went to the family court, they gave me mad agony. I fought and I fought, no end to my mad agony. Now I have to pay child support, despite all my menagerie. My lawyer's bill, they're chasing me still. It's all just more menagerie. Menagerie, menagerie, hopelessness, futility. My love has been turned back on me. My love is now mad agony. Thank you.
grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Hello again. This is Amfortas with part two of a podcast entitled The Justification for the New Stolen Generation. In this part, I will look at some of the guiding principles advocated in the Bible of the Family Court, the 1973 book, The Best Interests of the Child, The Least Detrimental Alternative. It also guides the Family Court's multitude of professional hangers-on, the rent-seeking scum described in Part 1. I will show the detrimental effects of seeking the least detrimental alternative. In the introduction to the paperback edition, it says, there is little consensus in law or science about what best interest means. In the absence of a clarifying definition, personal preferences of lawyers, judges, and social workers may govern decision-making. And when two adults compete for a child's custody, best interests of the child can easily be subverted by being equated with the best interests of the more deserving adult. And subverted it easily is, by lawyers and judges, and particularly social workers, who do exercise personal preference. There are doubtless many amongst us who are well familiar with this effect, as the family law makes it clear that it is a competition, and the most deserving parent is established on the basis of genitalia, and that deserving, supported by a biased professional machinery. Other potential and real failures of the system are introduced. For example, it says, failure to recognize and respect cultural differences in the way parents interact with their children may result in removal of children from their parents based on a state agency's culture-bound perception of abuse. Indeed. But I would take it further. Gender differences are not even mentioned, in line with the then-developing feminist theory that men and women were the same. It underpins the family court view that a father is redundant and that a child can do without a father altogether, as it will get all it needs from the mother. Also, state agencies have their own culture, which is quite different from day-to-day life, as any taxpayer knows. How real is the life reflected by the tax form manual? Do we really expect the courts to be any different, rule-bound and prejudiced as it is? It is prejudice in the sense of prejudgment, in the expectation that everyone who walks in the door must fit some predefined mould or template. Roles are allocated, and the main mould used is gender. The book's introduction includes a number of points of advocacy which serve to warn against the very obvious biases that can creep into the system. Biases which have subsequently crept in with a roar of welcome by the practitioners. Bias even makes its way into the introduction's own wording. The interests of the child, the introduction says, are to be considered separate and apart from the interests of her family. as a unit. If only if and when family fails to provide care according to minimal cultural standards. Notice that. A Freudian slip, perhaps? The authors refer to the generic child as her. As far as I can tell, they continue to use only the female gender for this purpose throughout the book. There are no his or him, other than in specific cases. Elsewhere in English, where the male word is used to include the female, an age-old lexical convention, it is deemed sexist, not PC. But not the other way round, of course. By sticking to she and her throughout their book, the authors set a tone which does injustice to fully half of their intended words. What are we to conclude? Are the authors pandering to a prejudiced audience, or are they subtly teaching them? Another potential failure is flagged. Once the family ceases to function adequately for a child, it says, if the child is abused or abandoned, or when separating parents cannot agree on custody, the state should intervene. This is interesting. Parents arguing over custody are, in this sense, automatically lumped together with neglectful and abusive parents. Parents are quite capable of having alternative views on custody while not neglecting nor abusing their children. The precision of language is important here, and this already exposes an assumption that goes unquestioned. It is the thin edge of just one of many wedges. Is it not possible to establish laws which require intervention only if there is neglect or abuse? What if there was a default position of joint and equal custody and access, and to interfere with that or fail to step up to one's responsibilities should be considered as abuse or neglect? That, I suggest, would be a far better approach. Mendacious and vilifying argument against joint custody is one of those issues at the torrid end of feminist vituperation. Another issue raised in the book. Once the state intervenes, it must put the child's interests first, the authors say, over and above that of even the most deserving of adults. Placement of a child, they say, must never be used to compensate an adult who has suffered misfortune or injury or injustice at the hands of another adult or the state. Otherwise, respect for the blood tie can only too easily be turned against the child's interests. The authors seem appropriately concerned that the child placement should not be used as compensation, but they don't say anything against punishment for a parent. Blood tie is of no consequence. It matters little to them. The child is not the parent's child once she or he reaches a court, it implies. It is already a ward of the state. A juggernaut can and is driven through these gaps. All other areas of law, all people are considered equal before the law. Classes of people are not to be considered. Men, women, rich, poor, they are all to be treated equally. The landowner and the peasant have been treated as equal before the law since Magna Carta. Not in the family law, though. A superior class has been created. Children. Now, who's going to argue with that? Adolf Hitler knew the answer. No one, if you tell them that it's in the best interests of the children. And especially if the children are given over to the mother, who becomes dependent on the state. Well, I do. I argue with it. And invite you to as well. It is advocated that the placement should be unconditional. Later on in the book, the authors argued that the court should not even assign visitation to a non-custodial parent. It seems that the custodial parent's attitudes, motivations, and actions are to be considered above reproach. There is no suggestion that obstructing the child's relationship with a non-custodial parent or undermining his or her parental authority is to be considered abuse or neglect. The sole custody model is first stage parental alienation. Parental alienation is child abuse. It follows that sole custody model is child abuse too. This 1973 book was written well ahead of data gathered over the subsequent 40 years, which show the effects of the application of the book's guidelines. Fathers have been driven from the family and from children's lives. A culture of fatherless families has become the norm. Fatherless families outnumber families with fathers. Single parenting is common and increasing. This is largely single mothers enthralled to state support and control. Men and fathers are marginalized at best and vilified in public policy. Children without fathers have increased problems and risk in all major aspects of their lives. Remember the best interests of the children and saving them from abuse, neglect, and abandonment? Family courts create precisely the single parent homes in which actual abuse and neglect is more likely to occur. Fathers are forced from their children's lives, and the public is told that they have abandoned them. According to the United States Department of Health and Human Services, children of single parents had a 77% greater risk of being harmed by physical abuse. By whom, you might ask? They have an 87% greater risk of being harmed by physical neglect and an 80% greater risk of suffering serious injury or harm from abuse or neglect than children living with both parents. Again, who is the parent inflicting these serious injuries, abuses, and neglect? The father isn't there. He's been driven out. Britain's Family Education Trust reports that children are up to 33 times more likely to be abused in a single-parent home than in an intact family. Again, the father is not the one doing it. He has been dispossessed. The educational achievement of single-parent children is lower. Drug use is far higher. Pregnancy in teen years is far higher. Delinquency is higher. Most prisoners in our jails are from single-mother homes. The ills to society mount. A stolen and abused generation, justified by 1970s Marxist ideology. I finish here. Thank you for listening, and please ask your friends to listen too. Send them a link. I thank my producer and friend, the men's rights activist Christian Jay, for his technical and distribution assistance. And I also acknowledge the Father's Rights blogger, Just Another Disenfranchised Father, for the theme and some points. I dedicate this podcast to my estranged daughter, who I miss so very, very much, and my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. Written and spoken by Amfortas. Ask, who does the Grail serve?
It's not a pretty sight. I did my best. Maybe I wasn't always right. Now I'm alone. My family is gone. My world has caved in, and I'm all alone. Now I'm shaven in a basin full of tears. I've been cut, but I ain't bleeding. I'm shaven in a basin full of tears. My children have been taken away. I'm alone with my worst fears. My worst fears.
In distress, meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And thanks to the miracles of modern technology, we're talking with Van Fortis, the psychologist from Tasmania. You there?
Yes, I am.
Great work you've done. We should let you tell people how they can get onto the web and listen to all these things if they...
Yes, most of my podcasts are held on a repository called SoundCloud, SoundCloud, soundcloud.com. And if you just type in Amfortas, then it will call up about 12 of them.
And how do you spell that?
Amfortas.
And I understand that was... Tell me again.
Amfortas? Mm. Amfortas was the king who was keeper of the Holy Grail.
Right. And why did you call yourself that?
I think there is wisdom within the men's rights movement which people are searching for.
Well,
I keep it.
I was going to ask you that, really, because, I mean, it's usually used as a term of abuse. Well, it is used as a term of abuse by many feminist groups these days, and there's nothing less fashionable than a men's rights activist.
Well, that's right. Well, of course, the German Wehrmacht didn't like the Allies either.
Right. Right. All right. Now, the next piece that we're going to play, we've only got time, unfortunately, to play the first part of this, but we will play the rest of it in the coming weeks, is called Give a Dog a Bad Name. Now, can you just introduce it for us?
Yes. Well, it follows on nicely from the last two podcasts, because family court judgments are not made in isolation. They are made within a set of social attitudes which are driven by the media. So this Give a Dog a Bad Name looks at the media treatment of men. And it's of interest that, it might be of interest to some listeners that this particular podcast that we're going to play was printed in the Mensa Journal this month. That's Mensa, the High IQ Society.
You're a smart so-and-so, aren't you?
who considered it important enough to publish. In it I mention that even some prominent early feminists have become appalled at the level of vilification of men in our society, which have been driven by their sisters.
That's true. We've interviewed people like Erin Pitsey, for instance, who was the woman that founded the first women's refuge in Britain.
A wonderful woman.
Oh, and it was a fantastic interview. We had more attention given to that interview than virtually anything else we've ever done. It was downloaded across the world and listened to across the world. It was a fantastic interview, too. What a fascinating character she is.
She's an excellent example of a woman with a good sense of balance, and I think it's important for feminists to understand, or women in general to understand, that men's rights activists actually like women. It's the ideology of feminism that we're fighting against.
Right. Okay, well, we're going to play Give a Dog a Bad Name, and then we'll be back to close the show talking with Em Fortas, a psychologist practicing in Tasmania. Here we go.
Hello, this is Em Fortas, and the title of my podcast today is Give a Dog a Bad Name and Expect to Get Bitten. I dedicate this podcast to my estranged daughter, for whom I grieve, and my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. Feminism has long drawn attention to and fought against stereotypical and sexist portrayals of women in mass media. But new research shows that media portrayals of gender have largely executed an about-face in the past decade or so. There is a deliberate and unprovoked gender war. In the main target of discrimination is not women, according to the research, it is men. In this podcast, I will look at the evidence. It is comprehensive. And in part two, the unintended effects, if indeed they are unintended. The feminists' so-called gender studies have claimed that mass media portrayals and images are key influences that both reflect and shape society's views of women and women's self-identity. They do not consider men. As well as attacking so-called sexist media portrayals, such as Page Three Girls and Girly magazines, which incidentally feature young, empowered women taking their clothes off without a skerrick of duress and doing what they want to for copious amounts of money. Feminists have challenged objectification, marginalisation, trivialisation and other negative portrayals of women in movies, advertising, TV drama and other media content. Although it is increasingly hard to find any such representations not driven by women themselves, their argument that such portrayals are damaging have won eager support from legislators and from most media professionals, including filmmakers, advertising producers and editors. After all, it is women who are the primary consumers of media's fruits. Until recently, gender theorists and media researchers have argued and lied or simply assumed that media representations of men are predominantly positive. Men have allegedly been shown in mass media as powerful, dominant, heroic, successful, respected, independent, they say, and in other positive ways conducive to men and boys maintaining a healthy self-identity and self-esteem. All things that feminists do not like one bit. But hey, Errol Flynn died decades ago. Marlborough Man too. The mendacious feminist view has come under challenge over the past few years. John Bennion, a Welsh academic, explained how masculinity was portrayed in the British quality press, including The Times, The Guardian and The Sunday Times, and more, over a three-year period from 1999 to 2001. He didn't look deeply at the more crass tabloid press where matters are considerably worse. Susan Faludi's 2000 bestseller Stiffed, The Betrayal of Modern Man, also finds and exposes the myths and lies and rings alarm bells about the false image of men in our society. Bennion concluded in his 2002 book Masculinities and Culture that men and masculinity were overwhelmingly presented negatively and as something dangerous to be contained, attacked, denigrated or ridiculed. In Australia, a broader and more extensive content analysis of mass media portrayals of men and male identity was undertaken in 2005 at the University of Western Australia by Dr. Jim McNamara. It focused on news, features, current affairs, talk shows and lifestyle media, and found that men are widely demonized, marginalized, trivialized and objectified in non-fiction media content that allegedly presents facts, reality and truth. Examine the quality and scope of the evidence. The study involved collection of all editorial content, no cherry-picking, referring to or portraying men from 650 newspaper editions, that's 450 broadsheets and 200 tabloids, 130 magazines, 125 news bulletins, 147 TV current affairs programs, 125 talk show episodes, and 108 TV lifestyle program episodes. They were from the 20 highest circulating and rating newspapers, magazines, and TV programs over a complete 6-month period. Media articles were examined using in-depth quantitative and qualitative content analysis methodology. This comprehensive and exhaustive research found in volume that fully 69% of mass media reporting and commentary on men was unfavorable, compared to just 12% favorable and 19% neutral. Men were predominantly reported or portrayed in mass media as villains, aggressors, perverts and philanderers, with more than 75% of all mass media representations of men and male identities showing men in one of these four ways. More than 80% of media mentions of men in total were negative, compared with 18.4% of mentions which showed men in a slightly positive role. The overwhelmingly negative reporting of and portrayals of men in mass media news, current affairs, talk shows and lifestyle media was mainly in relation to violence and aggression. Violent crime, including murder, assault, armed robberies and attacks such as bashings, accounted for almost 40% of all media reporting of male violence and aggression, followed by sexual abuse, 20.5%, general crime, 18.6%, and domestic violence, 7.3%. Disregarded is the fact that crime is a feature of a tiny minority in our society, And the vast majority of men are law-abiding, family-supporting, self-sacrificing chaps going about their lawful occasions. Men who are increasingly dismayed at the ease and frequency of which women denigrate them. Other topics of media courage of men were fatherhood and family, male sexuality, work and career, and men's social behaviour. In all of these categories, men were predominantly reported and portrayed negatively. Fully one-third of all media discussion of male sexuality examined in the study was in relation to pedophilia, which demonstrates the appalling distortion inherent in debate on men, given that an infinitesimal proportion of men are pedophiles. Fatherhood, a prominent also-ran subject, was discussed in 361 media articles and features during the period of the study. Some media coverage positively discussed men as fathers, pointing to increasing recognition of the importance of fathers in children's lives. However, along with the recognition of the importance of fathers and the depth of many men's emotional connection with their children, discussion contained an almost equal number of criticisms of men as deadbeat dads, commitment phobic, and as perpetrators of domestic violence and sexual abuse within the families. That sexual abuse is far less common in a family with a biological father in it than without, in fact statistically negligible, is totally ignored or suppressed. Men are exclusively portrayed as the perpetrators of domestic violence and child abuse, despite evidence of violence and abuse committed by women. The National Family Violence Survey in the US, for instance, found women just as likely to commit violence against men as men are against women. And a US National Incidence of Child Abuse and Neglect report in 2000 that found that where maltreatment of children led to death, 78% of the perpetrators were female. Where is that ever reported in our media? What an image of men to present to the target audience of the media, the primary consumer, women. They know that women want to see men as bad, it seems, in order to justify buying stuff from the media's sponsors. The media's deliberate, contrived image of men is wrong, very wrong, factually and morally. The Australian Advertising Standards Bureau reported in 2005 that TV commercials drew a record and increasing number of complaints from men during 2004, while those from women are decreasing. The Australian Federal Government's $73 million advertising campaign against domestic violence, which targeted only men as perpetrators of DV and only women as victims, was labelled propaganda against men, with many men criticising its negative and blatantly false stereotypical portrayals, as reported in The Age of January 3rd, 2005. One notable Australian commentator described it as the worst piece of deliberate government black propaganda against a biologically distinguishable group ever seen outside of Nazi Germany. Doris Lessing, the famous British early feminist author, said at the Edinburgh Book Festival in August 2001, "I find myself increasingly shocked at the unthinking and automatic rubbishing of men, which is now so part of our culture that it is hardly even noticed." She went on to point out, "The most stupid, ill-educated and nasty woman can rubbish the nicest, kindest and most intelligent man, and no one protests." Her audience was stunned. One could add that intelligent, educated TV presenter and news editor women are as bad as their crude, nasty sisters, seeking every opportunity to create a false image to suit their anti-male agenda. Indeed, their university education in women's studies lies at the root of their systematic and public misandry. Stupid is also an increasing thematic portrayal of men, especially in television adverts, which the Australian study did not cover. Men are routinely portrayed as fools, idle, good for nothing, and inept, usually a second fiddle to their so much smarter and more decisive female partners. In adverts, the suave, empowered, successful executive woman is married to a stupid boy man who cannot open a can of beans and whose children are more capable at doing year four homework than he is. Canadian authors Paul Nathanson and Catherine Young, in a controversial 2001 book, Spreading Misandry, The Teaching of Contempt for Men in Popular Culture, reported widespread examples of laughing at men, looking down on men, blaming men, dehumanizing men and demonizing men in modern mass media. They concluded, the worldview of our society has become increasingly both gynocentric, focused on the needs and problems of women, and misandric, focused on the evils and inadequacies of men. This seems pervasive in too many TV dramas. It is clear such TV shows seem to be preaching a message of defer to the woman as the only way of impressing her or stopping her being violent. And failure to do so will result in a smack to his face. Violence towards men, physical and verbal, direct and indirect, is treated as comedy or deserved. Whatever happened to there is no excuse to violence? Doris Lessing said, men seem to be so cowed that they can't fight back, and it's time they did. Now, how does one expect men to do this when there is so much legislation that forces them to keep their opinions and protests to themselves, and so much misandric vilification in all arms of our media-driven culture, the media that just won't give men a voice? With the rapid rise of female and feminist influence, seemingly devoid of the famed and hubristically claimed empathy and compassion, our media institutions are dominated by subtle verbal thugs. How do you think it affects justice in the family courts, where an industry of rent-seeking hangers-on, suffused with false and awful images of men, pass judgment? Men are less cowed than chained to a post in the backyard like a dog. In part two, I will examine the effects of this chaining up. I will show how women have lost a valuable resource, thrown it away. The care and concern of even the nicest, kindest and most intelligent men that Lessing refers to. And worse, for women. Mistreated dogs bite. My thanks to Christian Jay for his production skills and assistance in bringing this podcast to you. Ask who the Grail serves. Now, go to part two.
Sisters doing it for themselves. We have Amp Fortas on the line. Thank you so much for all the material you've provided. Very interesting stuff.
Well, look, thank you very much for airing it, John. I really do appreciate it, and I think the messages need to get out.
Right. So you'd never done podcasts before this at all?
Well, not until my son encouraged me and gave me a podcasting microphone for Christmas.
Oh, right. Right. And so what's the whole experience of doing them like? I mean, there's quite a number of them now.
There are, and they take quite a bit of production too. You know, I've been lately doing a couple in conjunction with other people, and the amount of backwards and forwards editing of the script is really huge. I mean, we try to get factually absolutely exact and try to get the wording exact, and I'm not a broadcaster, let's face it, you know, I'm just a chap.
Well,
and we try hard.
We had absolutely no radio experience when we started 9 years ago now. In the year 2000, Dad's on the Air began, and none of us had ever been near a radio station before.
Well, this is where we guys have to learn new skills.
You do, don't you?
and they say that we can't communicate.
So, just in closing, I'll just wind up as we began, really. The whole thing about this attack on shared parenting in Australia now, what's your view on it? It's such a reactionary turn to the dark ages.
Well, it is, and it is a feminazi plot, really. They're not in the slightest bit interested in proper families. There is a strong move in our society to destroy families altogether, to create, you know, so many variations of marriage that marriage doesn't seem to matter anymore, and to think that your parents are interchangeable with almost anything of any sort of sexual background. A child needs a father and a mother. It needs its own father and mother.
Well, just repeat, how do people find them?
How do people find the podcast?
Yes.
SoundCloud.com.
And don't forget that you can listen to this program at www.dadsontheair.net at your leisure. It has been redesigned. Wonderful work by our researcher, Greg Andreessen. That's www.dadsontheair.net. We'll be back next week with a Canadian special. We'll be back.
We're dead on the air.